here. Thank you very much to the committee that invited me here, and thank you to Dr. Barb Tilley for hosting me since I've been here. It's been exciting. So you'll learn this as I get going, but I was born and raised in Southern California. Woo, in the house. Where? Know where it is, totally. Yes. No need to go on. Yes. I grew up right outside of Los Angeles. Okay. Yeah, it's my homie. Peeps in the house, that's great. But and then I did graduate work in Tucson, Arizona. Okay. And then I lived in Tampa, Florida. Let's just stop now, this is awesome. But now I'm in North Carolina, in Greenville, North Carolina, where for the first time in my life I actually have four seasons, but none of them are like this. North Carolina, loves in the house. So thank you very much for hosting me. I have had fun in the snow, but maybe that's because I know for me it's temporary. I don't know, but I hopefully will be flying out tomorrow, or you might see me Monday. So let's get going. I'm going to try to watch the time. I've been given a certain amount of time to talk with you, and then a certain amount of time that we can have some questions, discussion. Hopefully this does move into more of a conversation. That'd be great. So let's go. So the images projected are school pictures of me as a young child in the 70s. So between the images is a reminder that in 1975, Public Law 94-142, what we know today as the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA, was passed. As a child growing up in the 1970s, Sunday morning in my house had a routine. My brother and I would watch Popeye cartoons. It was the 70s. For as long as we could until we had to get ready for church. While we were cleaning up and changing, my mom or dad would change the TV channel to a televised church service. So when I was all ready to go to church, always before my brother, I would go back and sit in front of the TV until it was time to leave. I didn't watch the preacher standing behind the pulpit, but I did watch the sign language interpreter sharing the screen. So my first exposure to the deaf community in America was actually through a sign language interpreter in the little bubble of the right side of the screen interpreting a sermon delivered by a Baptist preacher. So the black and white image that you see projected, it's Sue Wilmington. She was actually one of those early interpreters who was in that bubble. Now, definitions. The phrase deaf community with a little d refers not only to deaf, capital D people, those are people who use American Sign Language and share common cultural values, traditions, and social patterns, but also to hearing participants such as friends or relatives and deaf people, lowercase d deaf people, who are those who have physical hearing loss but may not subscribe to all those values of capital D deaf culture, but they are active in the community. For me, this early introduction to the deaf community in America illustrated a connection between religious rhetoric and sign language. As I became more a part of the deaf community through studying sign language, studying deaf culture, and even interpreting, this connection surfaced in other ways and led me to the understanding that historically, members of the deaf community used religious rhetoric to preserve and support sign language, and thus, an emerging deaf community. So in my book, Signs and Wonders, I argue that religion has provided the deaf community with a powerful language to convey their authority in struggles to preserve sign language and to actually advocate for its use. What is necessary for today's discussion are some more clarifications of definitions. So for this study, I define rhetoric as the use of language to influence thoughts and behaviors. So religious rhetoric is the use of language that has features of religion, religious themes, metaphors, biblical references, all those things that are used to influence the thoughts and behaviors of audiences. In my book, I analyze the ways in which sermons and speeches of deaf community leaders and narratives of deaf community members use religious rhetoric to promote sign language. These works are historical, they're also contemporary, they're sacred, they're secular, they're collected from Gallaudet University's archives, they're published sources, and I even observe some deaf congregation services. I show that the American deaf community, by evoking biblical themes and references, has overcome the oppression of a dominant hearing community that suppressed the use of sign language or that continues to actually devalue sign language. This is important work. It's important work to a variety of audiences because I examine how a community establishes and maintains their individual identity. This study is especially important because the deaf community is an often overlooked community. It's one we don't look at necessarily in rhetoric, despite the fact that they've solidified their identity through their arguments and advocacy for their language, sign language. The deaf community's use of religious rhetoric as a means to create and preserve an identity through language has strong historical roots. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, the American deaf community's use of religious rhetoric empowered their arguments by connecting with a dominant hearing community of like-minded believers. So pictured here in a black and white headshot is Thomas Hopkins Gallaudet, the principal for the first successful school for the deaf in America. He took the podium on April 20th, 1817 at the opening assembly for the Connecticut Asylum for the Education and Instruction of Deaf and Dumb Persons, later what would be called the American School for the Deaf. He proceeded to deliver a sermon which many have claimed was signed and spoken. Gallaudet's central text for the sermon was Isaiah chapter 35, verses 5 through 6. And if he did sign, it may have looked something like this. So it'd be, "Then the eyes of the blind shall be open, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap as an hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing. For in the wilderness shall waters break out and streams in the desert." Gallaudet began his sermon acknowledging the power of God to open the ears of the deaf and loosen the tongues of the dumb. He quickly moved to the justification for the school that he'd be leading, assuming his own power to give the deaf and dumb, or lower creation, a language of their own, and with such language, a knowledge of Christ, so they too could be converted. Gallaudet identified his position as principal in the New Connecticut Asylum for Deaf and Dumb Persons as his ministry. It was a calling and a practice of his Christian benevolence, reaching down to help those less fortunate than he. Before Gallaudet, there were many educators of the deaf. And like Gallaudet, many of these men saw their work as their service to God. One of the earliest records of a sign system used for communicating with deaf people is actually from 16th century Spanish monk, Fray Melchor de Ibla. By the 17th century, Europe was influenced by Spain's success with educating the deaf children of noble families. In England, books were published on how to educate the deaf, and soon educators began to cater to deaf children of wealthy parents. But it's in the 18th century when European schools for the deaf children emerge using a strictly oralist approach. Deaf studies scholars Van Cleve and Crouch note, "Foremost among these were German schools that followed the oralist pattern established by an 18th century teacher, Samuel Heinicke. In the 19th century, oralism was usually called the German method. These early European schools, as well as the Braidwood Academy in Scotland and the Institution for Deaf Mutes in Paris, influenced the deaf educational system here in America. So these two philosophies of how to educate deaf students, manually versus orally, they actually opposed one another, and they set the stage for a long debate that even continues today. The Braidwood Academy, it was an oral school that attempted to teach deaf students mastery of speech, and thus their view, mastery of reason. Many wealthy American parents would actually send their deaf children to the academy, hoping they would return home able to speak and actually understand and reason in English. The success of the Braidwood Academy allowed for more schools to open throughout England, but they were unsuccessful in establishing a school in America. John Braidwood, the grandson of the founder of Braidwood Academy, was plagued with personal problems. Due to his drinking, his gambling, his personal debt, Braidwood ended up in jail rather than opening a school for the deaf in America. So in contrast to the Braidwood Academy, the Abbe Charles Michel de la Paix at the Institution for Deaf Mutes in France taught deaf students using a sign system. As an educator, Epi was unlike anyone ever before him. He took as his goal to give many deaf children some knowledge of language, albeit silent, rather than giving a small number a mastery of speech. Through encouraging deaf students to use their own language, Epi was perhaps allowing an emergence of a deaf community with its own language. Unlike the Braidwood Academy, that tried to convert deaf students to act hearing using speech and lip reading. Epée's successful teaching methods were passed to his successor, the Abbe Roche Ambrose Sicard. And Sicard set up a school in his own diocese. And in 1815, as the head of the Royal Institution for the Deaf in Paris, he took former students to London, where they demonstrated their accomplishments for many. In one of those audiences was Thomas Gallaudet. Back in America, leading businessmen and clergymen of Hartford gathered on April 13, 1815, to discuss the establishment of American School for the Deaf. The group of men believed they met with a divine purpose. Gallaudet was asked by these men to go to Europe and learn techniques to educate the deaf. And that's when he met Laurent Clerc during his travels. Clerc, who was deaf, was a student of and teacher for Sicard, whose work on educating the deaf Gallaudet was very familiar with. Gallaudet returned to the United States with Clerc, and on the trip home, Gallaudet worked with Clerc to improve his English, and Clerc began teaching Gallaudet sign language. Side note, this is why American Sign Language is heavily influenced by French Sign Language. Both men were embarking on what they thought of as a mission to do God's will. And Sicard referred to Clerc as the apostle of the deaf mutes of the New World. And Clerc accepted his journey to the United States as fulfillment of a calling by God. In 1817, citizens of Hartford, along with deaf students and relatives, were in the audience as Gallaudet delivered that sermon at the opening of the American School for the Deaf. And it was to these hearing individuals he hoped to appeal. Gallaudet claimed that the greatest advantage to educating the deaf would be benefits difficult for the hearing to actually understand. He said, "The most important advantages, however, in the education of the deaf and dumb accrue to those who are the subjects of it, and these are advantages which it is extremely difficult for those of us who are in possession of all our faculties duly to appreciate." According to Gallaudet, the hearing members of the audience who already had a language and religious conviction of their own would not be able to understand the significance of gaining sign language and through it an introduction to evangelical Protestant theology, as the deaf students would. Part of his mission on that day was to help the hearing community understand. And Gallaudet continued in his speech to compare the silence and thus ignorance the deaf live in to the dreariness of a dungeon. He said, "He who has always trod the soil and breathed the air of freedom cannot sympathize with the feelings of ecstasy which glow in the breast of him who, having long been the tenant of some dreary dungeon, is brought forth to the cheering influence of light and liberty." Gallaudet emphasized the ecstasy deaf students would feel once they were removed from the bondage of ignorance. Through these vivid metaphors, Gallaudet appealed to the emotions of the audience to garner support to educate the deaf in Hartford area. But he also appealed to the ethical convictions of that audience. So like other missionaries of his time, Gallaudet claimed that deaf students were less fortunate because they had not engaged with language to learn about religious doctrine. Gallaudet claimed that through teaching the deaf students a sign language, he can lead them to understand how their offenses may be pardoned through the blood of the Savior, how their affections may be purified through the influences of the Spirit, how they may at last gain victory over death and triumph over the horrors of the grave. He argued that a school that would teach them sign language would bring light and liberty, freedom from silence, or freedom through language, through the belief in God. Since deaf Americans did not have language, Gallaudet believed they did not have the ability to know Jesus and experience the liberty he refers to. Gallaudet's subscription to evangelical Protestantism is apparent in that he finds freedom through his Christianity, or that God has provided salvation by grace. Gallaudet offers to teach the deaf sign language and to conduct their religious and general instruction all in sign language. For Gallaudet, sign language would become the light to deaf students in the dark. His use of religious rhetoric places a responsibility on the audience, a responsibility for the immortal soul of the deaf students in their presence. Through his sermonic rhetoric and the changes he caused, Gallaudet had a profound impact on deaf education in America and how we understand deaf individuals today. His use of religious rhetoric lent power to the view that the emerging deaf community was made up of intelligent human beings who needed the opportunity to be educated through the use and acquisition of sign language in order to come to know God. In the late 19th century, Gallaudet's views of how to educate the deaf with sign language actually came under attack. Oralists argued that deaf individuals should not be taught or use sign language. Rather, they should learn to speak and speech read. And similar to Native American students who were placed in boarding schools, deaf students who continued to use their language were punished. Deaf students who were caught signing had their hands shackled to their desks to prevent them from using their language. In response to this attack on the natural language of deaf individuals, the National Association of the Deaf, or NAD, was established in 1880. To protect the deaf community against the oralist threat, NAD sought films as a means to preserve and promote the values of deaf culture. As president of NAD from 1904 to 1910, George W. Videtz, who's pictured here, campaigned for the NAD Moving Picture Fund to record, preserve, and promote the use of sign language during a period when the domination of a strictly oralist approach to the instruction threaten the use of sign language in schools for deaf students. At this time, moving pictures already reached both hearing and deaf audiences because the films were silent and produced with captions and very simple plots. Recognizing the value in the means to reach both hearing and deaf audiences, NAD raised funds from 1910 to 1920 to create films that captured their language. The goals of these NAD-funded films were to persuade audiences to support their community and to garner support for the use of sign language. In these films, the use of religious themes was apparent. Deaf community leaders were filmed signing speeches, stories, or histories containing biblical references and themes. One of the more overt examples was the frequent filming of master signers signing the Lord's Prayer and sermons. Side note, on the cover of the book, as well as what's on the flyers for this talk today, the images of the woman signing, those are screenshots of her signing the Lord's Prayer. It starts out with "Our Father." So, these films illustrate the American deaf community's attempts to persuade audiences that they could be identified by their religious practices, once again affirming the relationship between the hearing and deaf communities. A reason for this selection was partially because of the familiarity the hearing and deaf audience would have with it. So the master signers can count on their audiences knowing the prayer by heart and add hope that the audience attaching the words that they knew with the signs that they saw, more people would understand how signs actually convey meaning and were used to construct a language. In addition, religious rhetoric presented a value of the emerging deaf community, morality. To deliver sermons in sign language and have them filmed, NAD showed a broader audience that the language of the deaf, their sign language, provided them access to the Word of God, which in turn helped them become civilized men and women, often of elite standing and highly educated, usually at Gallaudet College. Appealing to an audience who shared religious ideology, the discourse of the deaf community included religious rhetoric to convict audiences to support the values of the deaf community, mainly the place of sign language in education and lives of deaf Americans. The use of religious rhetoric is captured on the NAD films that were propelled by vedettes, served to promote an American deaf identity that was educated, moral, and willing to serve the community by educating others of its values. So this emerging deaf identity presented in NAD's films was in contrast to the deaf identity assigned to the opponents of sign language. So I've referred to oralists and to oral methods or oralism, and manualists or the manual method or manualism. So let me say something about oralists and manualists. Oralists argued for all deaf students to be educated using speech reading and speech. The argument was often supported by theories founded in evolution, as opposed to manualist arguments founded in creationism. Manualists often argued that gestural language came before speech. For some evangelical Protestants, the biblical account of the creation of man was interpreted to suggest that God had originally given humans the capacity for language and had left them to develop that capacity themselves over time. Of those who believe that language developed over time, many argued that some form of gesture or sign language must have been used before spoken language. To the manualist, to that generation of believers, the original language meant they were closer to the creation and to creator. So manualists viewed the use of sign language as a way of demonstrating a deaf person's closeness to God. These films of master signers served the deaf community by promoting the value of sign language with the use of religious rhetoric. So one of the most influential advocates for sign language, whose work clearly illustrates the connection between religious rhetoric and support for sign language, was vedettes. Let me turn the light off so you can probably see better. Is that better? Okay. His famous film speech, which is playing now, The Preservation of the Sign Language, was made in 1913 when oralists were gaining ground. The film was viewed at churches and social halls by both deaf and hearing audiences. Vedettes was a powerful signer and rhetor who carefully analyzed his audience before selecting signs to convey his passionate rhetoric. So vedettes here, in front of a curtained background, evoked biblical rhetoric to condemn the oralists. He cited the movement among oralists to ban sign language from every facet of deaf community. Vedettes signed, "They have tried to banish signs from the schoolroom, from the churches, and from the earth." He called the oralists false prophets who proclaim that the American way of teaching the deaf is a mistake. Vedettes depicted the oralists as heartless and truly uninformed of sign language and the lives of deaf people. Vedettes claimed the oralists, a new race of pharaohs that knew not Joseph, are now taking over the land and many of our American schools. Referring to the oralists as pharaohs that knew not Joseph, Vedettes cites that their lack of benevolence is a striking contrast to Gallaudet, who served the deaf community through his Protestant kindness, advocating for the use and recognition of sign language in the school, in the sanctuary, and in the social lives of the deaf community. Vedettes evokes the struggles of the Israelites who lost protection from their more compassionate ruler after Joseph died. The Israelites went on to face slavery under the new rulers or pharaohs. So according to Vedettes, the oralists would enslave deaf students by forcing them to learn speech and forbidding the use of sign language. So just as the fiery biblical rhetoric used by vedettes separates the oralist from the manualist, those who use sign language, so vedettes incites the deaf community through religious rhetoric. He concludes, his passionate presentation with, "It is my hope that we all will love and guard our beautiful sign language as the noblest gift God has given to deaf people." As a gift from God, Videttes is invoking a responsibility on the part of deaf Americans to preserve and promote sign language and to even maintain its beauty through proper use. Videttes argued the graciousness of deaf Americans should be visible in their signs. Videttes' film presentation is an example of graceful signing and a vigorous vigilance to advocate the values of a deaf community. These values included the belief that the use of sign language demonstrated a moral identity, sharing a Protestant theology with a dominant hearing society. As an activist in deaf community, Videttes employed a medium through NAD to spread his message to the most numbers. In addition to the advocacy of NAD, the deaf community has gained attention through other moments of activism in the 20th century. Sometimes those moments of activism were overtly tied to religion and religious rhetoric. Sometimes these moments of activism were not, as in many cases, we see a community responding to an apparent gap in access. The access gaps sometimes would emerge in telecommunication, film, television, or in consideration even of their ability to be intelligent and capable leaders, as in the Deaf President Now movement. These moments of activism amplify the separation that occurred and still occurs between deaf and hearing communities. Some of this activism continued to occur in the sanctuary with more and more churches recognizing the deaf congregant. Throughout the early 20th century, church organizations of different denominations developed ministries to deaf Americans. While the Episcopal Church took the lead in deaf ministers and deaf congregations, others soon followed. Lutheran, Methodist, Baptist, Latter-day Saints, Jewish, and Catholic ministries began serving the deaf throughout America. As more and more clergy desired to work with the deaf community, an increasing number of seminaries began adding sign language to their curricula. Interpreters played a key role in providing deaf congregants access to churches. And to this day, church interpreters are often volunteers who are visible reminders to hearing congregations of the language gap that exists for the deaf worshiper of a hearing church. So part of the success of the debate surrounding closed captioning and the decoder chip bill of 1990 specifically can be attributed to the awareness of the deaf community made through the 1988 Deaf President Now protest. March 6th through 13th, 1988 is a week of protest of events that is referred to as the Civil Rights Movement of Deaf People. The images projected here are from that 1988 protest. So a long history of being ignored or thought of as inferior was amplified on March 6, 1988, when Gallaudet University's Board of Trustees appointed another hearing president when viable deaf candidates were in their hiring pool. Students, alumni, and faculty marched through the streets of Washington, D.C. to the Mayflower Hotel where the board convened to express their outrage of the decision. This action kicked off a week of deaf revolution. Students and supporters closed down the campus for a week, educating the world of their fortitude and fight to be recognized as a minority worthy to be led by one of their own. Building on the civil rights rhetoric that preceded it, the DPN protests positioned the deaf community as a group worthy to receive recognition and fairness. As the national and international news began to cover the events unfolding at Gallaudet University, supporters from all areas of life came forward. Organizations pledged their support to the students. Politicians commented on the powerful message that students' protests sent. And civil rights leaders advocated for a deaf president. The Reverend Jesse L. Jackson is noted declaring, "The problem is not the students do not hear. The problem is that the hearing world does not listen." The deaf community through DPN educating a nation in a short time of all that deaf people are capable of, especially that deaf people could decide for themselves what was best. On March 11, 1988, 6 days into the protest, the newly appointed president, Dr. Elizabeth Zinser, resigned, fulfilling one of the protesters' demands. On Sunday, March 13, 1988, I, King Jordan, the top black and white photo there on your right. He was actually appointed then and announced to be the first deaf president of Gallaudet University. The American deaf community clearly demonstrated that after years of hearing people making decisions for them, that they were quite capable of making decisions for themselves. While the DPM protest was located in an educational context, it articulated much more than issues related to deaf education. It empowered a community to make changes in their own action and advocacy, and changed a hearing world's ignorant perceptions of the capability and language of the deaf. Deaf rhetoric emerged in this evolution, aligning it with civil rights rhetoric and Protestant theology of overcoming. Poignantly, it was a faculty member who is quoted summing up the protest with, "God made the world in 7 days, and we changed it in 7 days." Although much of the overt religious references have weaned, a society as a whole has leaned more towards secular rhetoric, the deaf community in America has continued to evoke biblical references and metaphors in contemporary advocacy initiatives. One significant example is the Deaf West Theater's production of Big River, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. So with Big River, Deaf West has educated audiences about the plight of the American deaf community while promoting a deaf identity that values sign language. Like the early deaf community leaders who preserved and promoted the deaf community on film, Deaf West Theater's production of Big River uses a familiar American story with Protestant themes to highlight the struggles and transformation of deaf Americans. By combining deaf and hearing actors who sign and sing, Big River is an example of new activism among the deaf community and an effective means of conveying the empowerment of the deaf community in a secular context. The ingrained Protestant influences on Twain was evident in Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. It's also present in Deaf West Big River. Deaf West employs the theatrical approach as a rhetorical strategy to reach many audiences with their advocacy for the recognition and use of sign language. So intertwining with Twain's Protestant themes, you have Deaf West telling the story of how not only Huck, who is on a spiritual journey, but also the story of deaf community, who is once placed in a defensive position, is now educating others of their skills and values from an offensive position. Deaf West's production of Big River is not intended to be a religious exploration of Protestant influence in the deaf community. However, in the foreground of the musical is the text heavily influenced with Twain's counter-theology, so religious themes are evident. So through lyrics and dialogue reflecting religious references to benevolence, redemption, and freedom, Deaf West's Big River appeals to the audience's knowledge of early America and struggles for equality. Big River's content appeals to the audience's emotions and moves the audience to not only identify with the conflict in Huck, but to also recognize the struggles the deaf community has endured as outsiders. Deaf West's Big River can be interpreted in not only the context of early American struggles with slavery, but also in the context of an American deaf community that employs religious rhetoric in their discourse as evident in the deaf characters. Deaf West Theater's production of Big River is unique because it combines deaf and hearing actors to tell a story with many levels of significance. Both hearing and deaf actors share the stage in Big River. Hearing actors speak and sing while signing. Deaf actors sign with their dialogue and songs, while hearing actors are used to speak and sing the parts of the deaf actors. So for example, the character Huck Finn on your left in the image is played by a deaf actor who uses sign language only. His dialogue and songs are narrated and sung by the character Mark Twain on your right, played by a hearing actor. The hearing actor speaking and singing the sign part of a deaf actor is always on the stage, in full costume, fully visible, but does not distract from the performance of the deaf actor. Deaf West provides a theater experience that allows both deaf and hearing audiences to enjoy the same performance without interpreters. So the deaf and hearing actors of Deaf West collaborate to communicate the story and effectively convey a deeper message about bicultural understanding, not just the black slaves and white characters, but also between the deaf and hearing characters. By analyzing Deaf West's Big River using a deaf lens, significant layers of meaning are added to the overall themes of benevolence, redemption, and freedom found in the musical. References to the intertwining of deaf education and the spiritual status of deaf students, the hold oralists had over sign language in the deaf community, and the empowerment of deaf community found in their own experience surface while you examine Deaf West's Big River through a deaf lens. So in Twain's original work, slaves are clearly portrayed as outsiders to the Protestant American community they're existing in. In Deaf West's Big River, deaf Americans play the role of outsiders as well. In Big River, it says, Big River continues to reinforce the difference of characters, both deaf and hearing, black and white. However, in one critical scene pictured here, a gospel-filled song invokes the conviction that all humans are equal because they are children of God. So in a funeral scene, the slave Alice sings while both hearing and deaf cast members, who are black and white, join her in signing how blessed we are. The song conveys the evangelical theology of redemption through God's Son, Jesus, and the demonstration of his redemption through faith in his Redeemer. The slave characters reconcile their captured orientation in this world, and the implication is the deaf community reconciles their fight to preserve sign language through the belief that God's loving hand controls their experiences. So on a candlelit stage, the cast signs and sings how blessed we are, as children of a God so good and true, to understand his moving hand and love for me and you. Because Deaf West staged this song with both hearing and deaf actors signing the song, they have emphasized the lyrics that all people are children of God. The evangelical theology expressed in these lyrics suggests that not only is the black slave signing the song as valuable as the white character standing behind her, but that the deaf characters are equal to the hearing characters. Every character on the stage in this scene signs the song. Since the life experiences of deaf Americans include battles to retain sign language, which is used in this scene to heighten the emotional appeal of the lyrics, the value of sign language to convey deeply religious and emotional sentiments is emphasized. Another important reference in this song is the religious metaphor of God's moving hand. The metaphors used in these lyrics convey the belief that God is in control of the life of and experiences of these believers. And in the context of a deaf perspective, God's hand is not only controlling, but symbolic of a conveyor of meaning, since sign language expresses meaning on the hands of a signer. Another song. The Crossing poignantly points to the hope both groups of outsiders, black and deaf, may have found in their religious faiths, that something better lied beyond the earth. This belief is common in American evangelical Protestantism that believes that Jesus Christ, crucified, dead, resurrected, is God's means of redemption. So in Big River, as slave Alice sings and her deaf daughter signs, Jesus will be there to meet me. He'll reach his hand in mine. One's reminded, not again of only evangelical Protestant theology, but the importance of hands to the deaf community. So as a community that identifies itself by visual language that's conveyed through the hands, the body, the face of the signer, it's Jesus' hand that will touch the deaf slave girl when she reaches heaven, the ultimate redeemer in Protestant theology. The song continues with, "I will no more be a stranger," referring to the outsider status assigned to both slaves and deaf Americans. The song this deaf slave girl signs implies that through salvation, freedom is found in death when she is no longer a slave. For many deaf Americans, freedom was gained with more rights from changed laws and policies, advocating the values of deaf Americans as fought for by deaf activists. Visually expressing the strife of the American deaf community, Deaf West employs a dramatic staging convention to relate the imprisoned stronghold the oralists had on the deaf in the first half of the 20th century. The result is that Big River is a work that raises the awareness of the audience who may gain appreciation for sign language and its purpose to convey meaning for the deaf. Deaf West Big River may even encourage audience members to accept the differences they may have with deaf people and become supporters of deaf culture through attending more productions by Deaf West Theater, supporting captioning at their local movie theater, or sharing with their friends what they experienced at Big River. So an audience is spreading the word, the deaf community achieved a masterful performance that was enlightening and entertaining. The mission of Deaf West Theater and the early activists in the deaf community is actually fulfilled. The religious rhetoric in this case of the deaf slave girl provides strength to a character. She finds power in a belief that is greater than the society keeping her in chains. So since rhetoric is about the power of language to change audiences' thoughts and behaviors, the deaf community was often disempowered by a dominant hearing community that was unfamiliar with sign language. As the deaf community struggled to maintain and preserve their language, they engaged the rich sources of religious rhetoric. Deaf advocacy for sign language was grounded in religious discourse in 19th and early 20th century America. As Gallaudet brought education to the deaf in America with the opening of the American School for the Deaf in 1817, he actually brought, more profoundly, Protestant religion, which would leave an imprint on the American deaf identity through the mid-20th century. What has emerged is what I claim is a deaf rhetoric that will forever maintain features of the heavy Protestant influence established at the inception of the first American School for the Deaf in 1817. Deaf rhetoric is evident in the early arguments to preserve sign language and the 21st century arguments for its recognition and value. And thank you.